With threats of tactical nuclear weapons, what is Russian President Vladimir Putin's ultimate plan for Ukraine?
Plan A, it appeared, was to use political machinations to convert the Ukrainian government to his side. And when that didn't work, Plan B was to invade and either take over or just reduce it to rubble.
Plus, UN investigators say Russian human rights atrocities in Ukraine are sadly becoming the new normal.
I truly fear that we have only scratched the surface when it comes to Russia's atrocities in Ukraine.
And later in the program, with its infrastructure under assault, Ukraine looks to renewed energy solutions. Today is Monday, April 3rd. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Lori London in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken headed to Brussels on Monday for a meeting of NATO foreign ministers. Talks are expected to focus on sustaining support for Ukraine. The meeting comes shortly after Finland's bid to join NATO was ratified by the Parliament of Turkey, the last of the Western Defense Alliance's 30 members to do so. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Turkey's parliament has approved a bill to allow Finland to join NATO. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg congratulated Helsinki on the fastest ratification process in the alliance's modern history.
Finland will formally join our alliance in the coming days. Their membership will make Finland safer and NATO stronger.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine last year marked a turning point for both Sweden and Finland, prompting both to reverse decades of non-alignment and apply to join NATO. Finland shares a 1,300-kilometer border with Russia. Neither Turkey nor Hungary has indicated it will ultimately support Sweden's bid. Finland's approval comes as Secretary of State Antony Blinken heads to Brussels next week for European Union and NATO meetings, focused on continued support for Kyiv. The last NATO foreign ministers' meeting was in Bucharest, Romania, last November. The U.S. strongly supports both Finland and Sweden joining NATO as soon as possible. One expert told VOA that Finland joining is a big win for both Helsinki and NATO, and a setback for Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Putin fought the war in Ukraine to challenge and to threaten the NATO alliance, to block Ukraine from entering. So I think that he was hoping to sort of set NATO back on its heels. And it must be very frustrating for him to see that in the case of Finland, the exact opposite has occurred, that the alliance is in fact expanding.
The recent visit by Chinese leader Xi Jinping to Russia will also likely be a topic of discussion in Brussels. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen had this to say this week.
We have to be frank on this point. How China continues to interact with Putin's war will be a determining factor for EU-China relations going forward.
Kimmich told VOA that it is difficult to gauge just how significant the meeting between Putin and Xi was, but there appears to be some tension lingering below the surface between Beijing and Moscow about how Russia is prosecuting the war with no end in sight. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
The United States is urging Russia to release two Americans who it's detaining. Associated Press correspondent Mimi Montgomery reports.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is asking his Russian counterpart to immediately release a Wall Street Journal reporter as well as another imprisoned American, Paul Whelan. In a rare phone call with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, Blinken expresses grave concern over the Kremlin's recent detention of journalist Evan Gershkovich on espionage allegations, according to a State Department summary. Calling for their immediate release, he also conveys Whelan, a Michigan corporate security executive imprisoned in Russia on espionage charges, is wrongfully detained. According to the State Department, Blinken and Lavrov also discussed the importance of creating an environment that permits diplomatic missions to carry out their work. I'm Mimi Montgomery.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Turk has presented the UN Human Rights Council with an update on the situation in Ukraine. I spoke with Lisa Schlein in Geneva. Lisa, it sounds like he's stating that 13 months after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, it would seem that people are almost getting numb to the atrocities.
Yes, absolutely. It was kind of the stock-taking because the Human Rights Council, which has been in session for and now going into its sixth week, he was kind of reviewing the situation of what's been happening in Ukraine over the past 13 months. And he started out by saying that what Russia did in terms of invading Ukraine was a sort of like a land grab that existed in ancient times. And what happened then is that a country would decide to attack its neighbor and then take over that country at will. And then he went on and he started to describe the massive human rights violations that have been occurring for more than 13 months. And he said that he was absolutely shocked to see how routine the reaction to these atrocities had become, you know, a sort of horrible new normal, which was affecting that people somehow or other perhaps were getting used to all of this suffering of the Ukrainian people and the destruction of literally hundreds of health facilities and the carpet bombing of cities and civilian infrastructure.
And I understand that the council this week is expected to adopt a resolution to extend and deepen the mandate of the UN investigative body.
Actually, today and tomorrow, UN Human Rights Council is going to be looking at 43 resolutions for possible adoption by the Human Rights Council. These resolutions come forth, sponsored by many different countries. It's not a given that all of them are going to be adopted, particularly about the resolution about which you were talking. This is a renewal of a mandate. It concerns the Independent International Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine, which actually had been appointed last year by a resolution adopted at the UN Human Rights Council to look into and investigate the alleged atrocities committed by Russia in Ukraine. And what is happening either today or tomorrow is a resolution asking for this independent international commission of inquiry on Ukraine be renewed. And given the kind of widespread condemnation that one sees from countries around the world regarding the invasion of Russia, it probably will be renewed.
What happens with these resolutions?
One hopes that it leads to accountability. Certainly, there is an investigation that goes on, and the commission of inquiry that was adopted last year, just a few weeks ago, came out with its first report about its findings, and it was really gripping and kind of horrible, where they were talking about the many, many, many atrocities that had been committed. Human rights monitors had gone around to different sites that had been occupied by Russia, and they gathered information regarding summary executions of civilians, torture that was inflicted upon them, and other atrocities. And the commission concluded that many, many of these atrocities could amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. And that's pretty serious. At least on paper, they're calling for accountability, whether Putin or any of the other commanders who are responsible for these atrocities will ever be brought to justice is an open question. But at least it's on the record that these really appalling crimes have been committed by Russia.
Lisa, I understand that Michelle Taylor, the U.S. ambassador to the UN in Geneva, also had some comments. What can you tell us?
Yeah, she was pretty appalled by the findings.
2 weeks ago, the Commission of Inquiry concluded that Russia's authorities have committed a wide range of violations of international human rights and humanitarian law in both Ukraine and Russia, and that many of these amount to war crimes, including willful killings, attack on civilians, torture, rape, and forcible transfers and deportation of children. They found that actions of Russia's armed forces and authorities may amount to crimes against humanity and called for further investigations. I truly fear that we have only scratched the surface when it comes to Russia's atrocities in Ukraine.
And she had a lot of praise for the work that had been done by the UN Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine in terms of its investigation. And she said that it's critical that the Council renew its mandate and make certain that the Commission has the needed resources to carry out its critical work. Unfortunately, money is always a problem.
Lisa Schlein, reporting for VOA from Geneva. Russia's ambassador to Belarus on Sunday said that Moscow will deploy tactical nuclear weapons close to Belarus's border with NATO neighbors. The comment follows Russian President Vladimir Putin's recent statement about his plans to station the tactical nuclear weapons on the territory of Russia's neighbor and ally. I talked about the threat of this escalation with Ian Hurd, international law expert at Northwestern University.
Well, let's get back to the beginning. I think Putin's underlying goal is to increase his own power and to make sure that there cannot be an independent government in Ukraine or in other of the neighboring countries that he's worried about. And what he's done with this invasion of Ukraine is sort of demonstrate that he would prefer to control the political independence of his neighbors, but if he can't do that, he's willing to just grind them into dust so that they can't function as independent entities. He did that in Chechnya. He seems to be doing it in Ukraine. So he seems willing to use any manner of military instrument to destroy the possibility of an independent Ukraine or independent countries on his border. Since that has not produced a defeat in Ukraine in the way that he perhaps expected, it seems like he's looking for any instrument he's got that will make it impossible for Ukraine to operate on its own. And that includes taking hostages, as he's done with the Wall Street Journal reporter this week. It includes threatening nuclear weapons. And it includes just destroying the cities and destroying the capacity for human life or the environment in these places. So it looks to me like he's looking for any instrument he can have that is going to either increase his leverage or just make life more impossible in Ukraine.
What is he going to gain if he destroys everything around him, though?
Well, it looks from the outside like he's quite afraid of independent countries on his border, on the Russian border. And by independent, I mean countries that are operating outside his sphere of influence. So Belarus, for instance, is run by essentially a puppet of Putin, and that's just fine with him. Ukraine was for a while and is not now a puppet regime of Russia, and that seems intolerable to him. So the plan A, it appeared, was to use political machinations to convert the Ukrainian government to his side. And when that didn't work, plan B was to invade and either take over or just reduce it to rubble.
Do you think that this is bluster when he starts talking about nuclear, or do you think he's actually willing to, you know, do anything, including that?
Not really my place to interpret what's on his mind. I think that it seems entirely up to his choice how much destruction he is willing to cause in order to eliminate the political independence of his neighbors. So far, he seems to have shown himself to be willing to use any level of destruction. In Chechnya, he sort of destroyed the place in order to eliminate the possibility of any political uprising. So his history seems to show that he's got no bottom below which, you know, he might fall. That said, it's not really clear that using nuclear weapons is his first plan. It looks to me like at the moment anyway, he gets something out of causing anxiety in the rest of the world by threatening to use them. And that seems to be the opinion of the American security apparatus, that this is bluster rather than any real preparation for using nuclear weapons. But obviously, we couldn't put it past him.
Ian Hurd, international law expert at Northwestern University. Thank you so much for your perspective. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. Since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine last year, Moscow has and continues to target critical infrastructure. And as deaths and destruction of the country's infrastructure continue to mount. I talked about it with Anna Chernikova, reporting for VOA from Kyiv.
It seems like things have held up pretty well, but I know it's definitely been an issue, whether it's electricity or water or, you know, any kind of power, it's been greatly damaged. Is that a fair assessment?
Energy sector was one of the main targets, especially starting from October last year. Russian forces were trying to... So every attack, every massive attack that Ukraine experienced during the period from October until late winter 2023, was the main target was always energy sector. One of the main targets, let's put it this way, but even in some periods, it was just the main target. And at the beginning, it was really quite a tough period for the whole country. There were very long outages, electricity outages. It was really a great trouble with energy supply, with heating, with water supply, especially in the areas that were either next to the front line or under occupation or just liberated areas. But October and November last year was really tough for the whole country. It was quite surprising that energy sector managed to handle this enormous problem more or less well, and I should say even quite well, because these outages were in place for a couple of months. But after that, Ukrainian energy sector kind of learned and kind of prepared of how to prevent outages. So when new massive attacks were happening, there were preventive outages in order to keep the system stable as much as possible.
And you have a report that you worked on looking into Ukraine's efforts to move toward green energy solutions.
Green energy sector was kind of evolving in Ukraine in the past years before the war, and in general, a lot of experts, a lot of energy players were talking about this importance of moving green, and not only in Ukraine, but across the world, this was a very common topic. And of course, Ukraine was also trying to, you know, be a part of this, you know, global green movement. And when outages began during this massive attacks, Ukraine faced this problem even more, because basically green energy could have been quite a good decision if we talk about particular industries or particular enterprises. And this particular story is about the school in Irpin. It was very badly damaged during the during Russian occupation and during Russian assault on Kyiv last year. And the school was rebuilt. And one of the organizations, foundations, Ukrainian foundations, started this project to basically make schools and hospitals energy independent.
And as Russia's targeted attacks on the Ukrainian energy infrastructure continue, as Anna just said, Ukraine has been inventing new ways to quickly restore and improve the resilience of its energy system and for green energy solutions. She brings us this story from Irpin, one of the hardest hit areas of the Kyiv region.
For months, the Ukrainian energy system has been the target of Russian attacks that leave homes, schools, and hospitals in the dark, sometimes for days at a time. This is encouraging Ukrainians not only to find unconventional ways to quickly rebuild energy facilities, but to consider possible alternative energy sources. This school in Irpin is the first to get its own solar power station, thanks to an initiative of the non-profit Energy Act for Ukraine Foundation and the support of international donors. Yuliana Onishuk, foundation founder and CEO, explained that the station consists of solar panels, inverters, and a system that allows the school to store solar energy and use it during power outages.
Our main aim was to ensure that the system storages are always fulfilled with electricity. In order to ensure that, we developed a technical solution that foresees that if we have a sunny day, the electricity that will be generated from the solar power plant will go to storage systems in order to fulfill them. It's a priority number one.
The station's battery storage system can provide the school with a power supply for up to 4 hours. The school's principal explains that the solar power station will allow schools to operate using power that is cheaper and greener than that provided by gasoline generators.
This is a breakthrough for education, that we simply become energy independent.
For Ukraine, 1 year into Russia's full-scale assault, energy security is one of its main priorities. The foundation plans to install similar solutions in a total of 100 schools and medical institutions across the country. 1 year on, the war has created many new challenges that Ukrainians face daily. But it has also created an environment for rapid innovation that is key to survival. Anna Chernikova for VOA News, Irpin, Ukraine.
Yulian Yeliboga is a U.S. high school student whose mother is an immigrant from Ukraine and whose father is of Ukrainian heritage. After Russia invaded Ukraine, Yulian wanted to help, so he started collecting warm socks for Ukrainian soldiers. Nina Vishneva has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Every morning, Yulian Yeliboga arrives at his Manhattan school an hour before classes start, joining classmates and teachers to help Ukrainian soldiers by sending them warm socks.
You're going to be over 300, I'd say, in the school, yeah.
It all started with a photograph.
I showed Yulian a picture where a soldier in the trenches is warming his feet over a makeshift candle.
The picture shook Yulian. His mother, Oksana, moved to the U.S. from Ukraine many years ago and works as an interpreter. His father was born in the U.K., but also speaks Ukrainian. Yulian still remembers the day he learned about Russia's invasion.
I was getting ready to go to sleep, and then I saw on CNN that war has broken out, shots were fired into Ukraine. And then that's when it really hit me.
Never in my life did I feel the way I felt on February 24th. The next day on TV, I saw Russian tanks destroying a cemetery. The monument bits were flying left and right. I was crying so hard, neighbors got concerned.
Thousands of volunteers in New York are helping Ukraine by sending humanitarian aid that includes medications and various essentials. Socks have been among the most urgently needed items for soldiers, no matter the season, so they became the focus of Yulian's efforts. Administrators at Yulian's high school have joined his cause and donated over 200 pairs of socks. After Yulian is done with classes for the day, he sends messages to sock manufacturers asking for donations. He has a clear goal in mind.
I want to go back to my mother's hometown and look at all the things that she has there. Open the door once again, look at the apple tree in the yard, and open up my mother's photo album just to see my mom's baby pictures again.
All the socks collected, more than 700 pairs so far, will be sent first to Poland and then to Ukraine. There, one of Yulian's mother's childhood friends is fighting and will help distribute the socks to other soldiers. Yulian says he will keep sending them as long as the war lasts. For Nina Vishneva in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that will do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Lori London.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.